Ever wonder what it would feel like to ascend the 3,000-foot super steep nose of El Capitan in less than 2.5 hours, racing up the granite as if Dog the Bounty Hunter and those creepy agents from the Matrix were hot on your heels? Ever wonder what it would feel like to have one of your rock crevice anchors snap off, the result being you free fell backwards more than 2,000 feet up? If so, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Tiger Gene, where we invite amazing people to discuss amazing stories about how they manifest that special ability we all have to rise above even the most daunting challenges. Get ready to pounce on life. Eric Lindner, one of your hosts today. Thanks for tuning in. Today's special guest is special in so many ways, but most fundamentally in that while all of our other guests have borne witness to reacting in awe-inspiring ways to adversities thrust upon them by the hand of Providence, today's guest, Hans Lorrain, as they used to say in the pickup hoops games of my youth, is all about taking it to the hole. His life's not been defined so much by reacting to a series of towering adversities. Rather, Hans has been about attacking them. One wouldn't be surprised to learn that after smacking away the pacifier, the first words out of his mouth in his crib, as he pulled himself up with one of his famous one-arm pull-ups onto a whirligig, were, "Bring it." And did I mention the adversities being towering? But we'll get back to that in a moment. Hans Lorrain, aka Hollywood's Hans, has described his twin passions as follows. I love to ascend big chunks of granite and climbing fast. Indeed, Hans has ascended El Capitan, Yosemite's iconic granite slab, more than any other human, 179 times to be exact, if my math is correct. And he's held the world speed record more times than any other human, 8 times to be exact. The first ascent took something like 45 or 57 days back in the 50s, if I can't recall exactly, one of those, a lot of time. Hans clocked in at 2 hours, 23 minutes, and 23 seconds, something like that, to ascend 3,000 feet up straight rock that's as hard as steel. And Hans didn't have any stuntmen. But before belaying our discussion with the world's preeminent rock climber, speed climber, ex-gamer, and one-arm pull-upper, I'd like to introduce my fellow host and friend of more than 39 years, Janet Hedrick, an Illini born and bred who, having grown up surrounded by corn as high as an elephant's eye, can easily tell the difference between a John Deere and a New Holland grain harvester blindfolded. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you, Eric. I'm happy to be here.
And you're in Sisters, Oregon, right?
Yes, that's right. Right next to the majestic Deschutes National Forest.
Well, be careful how you pronounce that. So without further ado, welcome, Hans. Where are you zooming in from now?
I'm at Sacramento Pipeworks Climbing Gym in Sacramento, California.
Oh, well, thanks for zooming in. Thanks for giving us your time. I know you're a busy, successful, famous guy all over the web. And you were at Yosemite a few days prior, were you?
Yeah, I just drove there this morning. Climbing out of the ditch, as I'll kind of jokingly say, a couple times while I was there.
I'm going to kick things off with a question, one question, prompted by the subtitle of your terrific memoir, the title of that being On the Nose, a lifelong obsession with Yosemite's most iconic climb. First, though, I love how you close the book by comparing what you do to, quote, bring the heat, love that expression, with what so many other people do, labor at things that are stone cold and about which they have no passion and their work is not precious to them. They hold no, quote, reverence for it, as you so often use. In other words, I love that. Still, Hans, I must say, given what you've done and not done, like climbing another few pitches up the nose, hoping but unsure there'd be room for you to sleep on a tiny ledge, or ignoring a doctor's advice regarding when it's safe to resume climbing with your broken fingers, because in your words, you, quote, love sleeping on the wall thousands of feet up of a mountain like a mountain goat. Here's my leadoff question. Is, quote, obsession in the subtitle, the obsession, just a euphemism for batshit crazy?
I'm here in present and talking about myself, so I'm going to say no. Obsession is not the same as batshit crazy. I'd say I'm super lucky, kind of in our pre-talk. I'm very lucky to have found something that has uncommonly motivated me or inspired me to delve deep into a certain topic. You know, my topic is climbing, right?
Right.
Gosh, there's so many other, you know, things to comment on. And I don't know where all we want to take this, but in a bio, when I get introduced to do talks in front of whether it's salespeople or outdoor young people at universities or wherever, or kindergartners, I always make sure if they left out of my bio that I'm a parent. I have a boy and a girl, or young man and woman now. I have a 21 and a 18-year-old. And I'll say that the work parenting is far more batshit crazy than climbing a mountain.
Oh, amen to that, Hans. I have a 22-year-old son. Hear you. Absolutely.
I am so glad you pivoted over to the family, and my apologies. I love the story about your daughter going up with your daughter and how she paused. She said, Dad, I'm good. The same spot you said you're good. And then you reflected gee, she's already ahead of me. She stopped at that, what, Sickles, some kind of spot. So I love it that you pivoted. And that's a perfect segue. Thank you. Because where I was hoping you'd get to was, I love this quote, and I think it was in another interview you gave. You said something, I think, I can tie everything and everyone I love back to the nose. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? And maybe, at least maybe not start, or start if you will, with your mother, because so many of the Tiger Gene guests go back to their mom, that their mom was such a critical player for them. So start wherever you want.
Well, my book On the Nose marks my 100th ascent of the nose. And I'm starting there is that, you know, we have an obsession with the Dekki system because we have 10 fingers, we're humans. And so 100 is the centurion thing is incredible. But what we should point out is that mountaineers, they might aspire to climb Everest, and most would do it once. 99.999% of mountaineers would climb Everest once, and that's it. Well, traditional rock climbers is kind of the category of climbing I do, would aspire to climb the nose of El Cap once. 99.9% of the people who climb the nose will do it once. So it's patently ridiculous that I've done it now 112 times. And as much as I am a fast time everything sort of guy and quantitative, in the back of the book, which I actually thought you were going to reference, is that I list the 83 different people that I've gotten to climb the nose with.
Yes.
And that's super important to me when you talk about family, not just bloodline family, but
yes.
I this will sound odd, but I'm immortal in those people's lives that have climbed the nose. Because imagine if you climbed Everest, you'd remember the two or three people you climbed it with, right? For the rest of your life.
Right.
Those people are immortal in your life. And I will be in those people's memory for the rest of life. So I'm kind of spreading my immortality by climbing with as many different people as I can up El Capitan.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad that's a great pivot and metaphor. That's wonderful.
Whether it's my, you know, brother or son or daughter that I climb it with, you know, that's just a further memory with them. Hopefully they'll remember other things about me, but I have climbed it with my son and my daughter and my brother and loved ones through time. I didn't meet my wife or ex-wife when I was a teenager and then have them the rest of my life. So I'm human, make mistakes.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're human.
Hans, are your parents alive?
My mother is alive. And I know I got to go round back to about my mom's influence on rock climbing eventually here. My father passed away in 1992.
And have you ever talked to your mother about climbing the nose with you?
I've asked her about climbing with me, and I've taken her climbing at a gym where she's just gone up, you know, 30 feet, maybe 20, 30 feet and said, okay, I'm good. And she, you know, as family, we would go around. I was one of four kids and we'd all pile on the station wagon with the dog and go camping and outdoorsy stuff. But it wasn't my parents that introduced me to rock climbing. They just introduced me to the outdoors.
To talk a little about where he grew up climbing on a boulder in a cow field in San Luis Obispo. Tell us a little bit of how you got started and your background before you, when you were, you know, how you got started, how you drew you to rock climbing.
So Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, I was down there with a business degree, pursuing one. And someone in the dormitory just asked, hey, who would like to go out rock climbing? And I said, oh, sure, I'd love to try that. Seemed interesting. And took us to a 20-foot high boulder in the middle of a cow field. And we, you know, at the time thought it was like this gargantuan thing with, we put ropes on it and there was all this quiver of gear, I call it, that we would use to protect us as we climbed, and just fell in love with it and started cheating on my track and field practices and would go climbing instead of running around the track or doing whatever pole vaulting sort of workouts we were supposed to be doing.
Pole vaulting, I can't even imagine. I think I might rather climb El Capitan or try to. I might get about 11 feet.
Launch yourself in the air as high as you can and then try to land on this pad that's not, you know, infinitely big without hurting yourself. It's, if you want to compare rock climbing and pole vaulting, you know, I think hands down pole vaulting is a little bit more ridiculous adrenaline. Look at me, I'm doing something crazy sort of thing.
Janet, you were a pole vaulter, weren't you?
I was a hurdler, not a pole vaulter. Hurdler, sprinter, long jumper. And not a particularly good one, I'm sorry to say.
You jumped off the earth, just not as high and crazy as pole vaulter. Very good.
Yes, that's true. I did. Running track and track and field seems pretty pedestrian compared to what you do today. I'm curious whether in your earlier life you did things that people would look at and say, oh, Hans is a daredevil. Did you scare your mother out of her wits with daredevil type things when you were a kid?
I'm going to have to say no more than any son. I climbed trees. And I think earlier you asked about my growing up. I was a military kid or brat. And so we lived in Virginia and Texas and Illinois and back to Virginia and then finally out in California. One thing my parents, I don't know if they insisted on it, but they always looked for a home near a place where there was forest or some sort of open space to play. So I don't know if that was a requirement or just luck, but we always had some cool place to play outside, whether there's forest in our backyard or parks and such. So they influenced me there and having to have open space to play. And with that comes, you know, wrecking bikes off the edge of sand dunes or falling from trees and breaking your legs or whatever it might be. And so again, I think boys generally scare their moms, but I don't think I did so any more than other boys.
So, but did you do both of those things? Break your legs, jumping a sand dune?
I did. I actually sprained my ankle. I fell from on top of like some crates or something and jammed my foot into my ankle when I was, I think, like 8 or 9 years old. And classic sort of thing, you're wearing a cast and there's always some family vacation happening when once someone has a cast on. And sure enough, it was true for me. We visited our cousins and they all decided they're going to hike a mountain in Santa Rosa, California. And I don't want to be left out. It was, you know, 1974 or something like that. And casts were cast. They were on until that bone was fixed. So you're just living with this stinky, rotten, dirty cast for weeks on end until it comes off.
That sounds awesome. That's a great element of childhood. And just a quick side note, where were you in Illinois? As a Flatlander myself, I'm interested in knowing that.
You know, I think I keep hearing from my parents because I was a little bit young then, but I think we were like an hour or within an hour of Springfield, which is the capital, I believe, right?
Yes. So possibly Chanute Air Force Base.
I'm guessing he would be near a base somewhere. Yeah.
That's where I went to college, University of Illinois, very close to there.
What were you studying there?
French, believe it or not. So then I became a lawyer. But the great thing about it was that I met Eric, and you talked about climbing with family, maintaining bonds with family and with friends. And Eric has been one of those people to me, among some of the other folks that we've had here on this podcast. So, Eric, I think you were about to ask a question when I interrupted.
No, there is no such thing as interruption, but Janet's referring to the other three people we all met in Chicago in 1982. Hans, I absolutely, again, coming back to that, I think a friend of yours termed, or you, I think, credited him with high psych level or something, a high psych level was this phrase that you used, I think, for value. And I really do. I wonder if, you know, when you look at these, so many of these super, I'm going to call it pecuniary wealth people, billionaires and so much money, a lot of times they're not smiling. A lot of times they're unhappy and sour. One of the very few things I remember from tax law was the government can't tax psychic income. And you talk about the psychic level. And I'm guessing that you are probably you sound like one of the wealthiest guys on the planet, that Forbes needs to do something different with their wealthiest people so that you're at the top because you brought all the high psych level with all these 83 people and all the friends and family, and that your psych level is so high that they need to do a new ranking. Do you feel that you're just such a wealthy guy according to the psych criterion?
Yes. And I'll say that, you know, if the whole point of taxing people by a government entity is to redistribute wealth, then I think when you see somebody like the guy who got bitten by a shark or people who run a marathon really fast and they're doing inspirational or motivational things to other people, like you see him or maybe you see me and see, like, well, I want to do it like Hans does, or I want to do it like Kuhn does. I think that was the gentleman who got bit by the shark. Right. Therefore, your psyche has been taxed, so to speak, and spread to everyone else.
Right, but in a non-zero, sum way. And I also love that you talked about how you, how fulfilling it is to inspire people. That person, can't remember, there's a man or woman, and Doctors Without Borders, and going up, helping people disabled or handicapped, the proper. Could tell us a little bit, I mean, one of your most inspiring, you felt inspired by when you were helping this person, or this person called you and said, hey, Hans, I just joined Doctors with Border. Those sounded like amazing high points in your life.
Well, some of them seem simple or even common. Disrelated from me, I hear like, oh, there's this lawyer who's been in a big law firm for, you know, X number of years, drives a brand new, let's just say European car, so we don't name anything, but super expensive, and decides, I'm just going to go to Costa Rica and run a surf shop. And you're like, you know, what? Well, what if it fails? Well, you know, who cares is one answer to that. But this is a story I heard secondhand from somebody, but a person came to a slideshow I gave, I don't know, 10 years ago, and he says, I saw you give a show 7 years ago, and I quit my job in Colorado Springs. I was working in a cubicle, blah, blah, blah. I just took the money I had, which I guess he had a good amount, but not a lot, and he flew to China, and he just traveled China, and he goes, you know what, I'm just going to, because I like rock climbing, I'm going to source a place to have some rock climbing gear made, carabiners or whatever sort of tools. And he did. He found the place where some other well-known rock climbing manufacturer, and they started making stuff for him, and he sold it, and he made a business of it and sold the business off. But he got to run, so to speak, in the climbing outdoor industry for 3 or 4 years selling these wares. And he just, it was so cool. Like, I didn't work for anybody, and I just adventured in China, and I was in the world of you know, the outdoor community that I loved selling this gear. And I was in a fortunate position where if it didn't work, it's fine. I could find another job. I have a degree, but if it did work, I got to play and make money doing things in something that I love, which is climbing. You know, for me, it wasn't the guy told me any stories about specifically being paid to climb, so to speak, but he loved the community of climbers and he got, you know, to pursue something, an aspect of climbing. He solved a problem. He provided gear at a reasonable price to people. Again, maybe not an uncommon story, but somebody just pivoted and instead of working with a white collar, so to speak, in a cubicle, they went and adventured the world to find something to do, you know.
You use this word. I love this word. You reverence. You use the word reverence, which I really like that word, reverence. And my wife and I were in Australia once just before we were one of the last ones to be able to ascend Ayers Rock, which before it was handed back to the indigenous people and was renamed whatever, a name I can't pronounce, Uru or whatever. And we actually hesitated, my wife and I, because that we might have been, you know, it might have been sacrilege for us to go up this sacred rock, which was going to be forbidden except for the indigenous people. And I'm wondering, I've been to Yosemite maybe 3 or 4 times. Just, I just feel it's such a spiritual place. It's just almost the navel. I know people have talked about Himalayas that way, but to what degree do you feel at times you are? I mean, I think the nose is some are called the rock chief. I mean, it's called this mm-hmm. name, almost a spiritual name. Do you feel you're in a spiritual place when you're there at all or very often?
I feel like it's a crucible for people to test themselves. And, you know, that may seem very climber-centric, but, you know, for hikers and outdoor lovers, it's this amazing topography that nature has given us there, I guess. Yeah. Because it's not just for climbers. I mean, there's a just amazing waterfalls, amazing places you can hike and be in, incredible places, you know, just camping next to a 100-foot or 200 or 500-foot waterfall, right, and hiking through the Sierras, just seeing the topography that you go through there in Tuolumne Meadows and Yosemite is staggering. It's just... Yeah. Staggeringly, like no other place on the planet.
I'm with you there. It's absolutely stunning. And I feel sort of that same reverence for the outdoors. Like you, my parents introduced me to the outdoors at a very young age, mostly because 4 kids on a teacher's salary, best entertainment you can get is being outdoors. And I have been in Yosemite and felt that same kind of reverence, to use that word again. And I know that when you made your 100th ascent, there were 2 women who went with you. One was from Britain and she was celebrating her 50th, and you took your co-writer with you. And it almost seemed to me as though helping them make the ascent and being with them and being part of the community that you referenced was more important than achieving the 100th ascent. Am I right about that? Or
100% right. And there's so many words I'm referencing, like neither of those women that went up with me were common. They're absolutely incredible women, and they were incredible in a non-climbing way, which I mean, I love uncommon people, but I love all people. But they just were so interesting. Fiona from England, she did not have the women's fastest time to the South and North Pole, but she had the human's fastest time to the North and South Pole, which is just cool. I'm competitive, so I like that. But I'm just like thinking, she runs an adventure company with her husband in England, and she had never been more than 3 pitches, which is 3 rope lengths, about, you know, 200 feet or 150 feet off the ground. And she said, "Hey, Hans," she called me, and because I had met her in Poland years before for a festival. And she said, "Do you think somebody like me could climb El Cap. And I'm like, of course you can, especially if you do it with me. And I just knew somebody that can survive by themselves out on the, you know, ice fields of the North and South Pole would be an awesome person to succeed, quote unquote, or suffer with, or do an adventure with. So involving people that have this historically observable resilience, I guess, to go and do mad adventures. You know, I picture her as somebody who would take the journey to the center of the earth. You know, she'd sign up right away, no matter what the chance of our outcome would be, because it'd be interesting to go, you know. And then Jamie, my co-author, she states or puts herself as like this embedded journalist, quote, on all the things she's been on. But she's been to Afghanistan and been on an all-women's cycling team in Afghanistan as an embedded journalist. And I'm just like, how did you come back from that alive? You know, that's nuts.
I've heard of that team and was absolutely amazed by it. Yeah. And, you know, I know that on that ascent, it took you multiple times longer because you were helping those women than if you had done it yourself. And that's part of what made me think that your own achievement was very much secondary.
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you, I guess. But I go back to like being selfish is that like, I want to be in the memories and lives of incredible people like Fiona and Jamie. And I'm fortunate that I'm the go-to person that knows a lot about climbing El Cap. So it's like, if somebody wants an Everest guide, they're probably going to look for Reinhold Messner or Ed Viesters or somebody like that. Well, if they want to climb El Cap, they'll look for me, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that it's a lucky thing for you that you get just as much out of the relationship with the people as you do from the individual achievement. And I feel that people who are tuned in only to the individual achievement are, like Eric said, not the most happy. And I think about, for example, billionaires who fly on a rocket in space because they can. Do they get as much out of that as you get out of climbing El Cap with some friends? It's just a curiosity. It's not really a question. Something I've thought about, though.
Jan, I love that comment. There was a great, someone wrote, without naming names and without getting into that political space, I mean, someone wrote about these billionaires just saying, why do we celebrate these billionaires? To me, they're just, quote, deranged hoarders, unquote. And with 37 homes and things of that nature. But Hans, one of the things we've tried to deconstruct with Mike Kuch, you referenced, and others, and Maritza Shelley, and these amazing people that have preceded you, and seems clear to you, is what are the kind of the markers, the genetic markers, the composite building blocks of the genome, and a couple things appear to kind of common denominators are shared by seemingly everyone, including you, in my opinion. I wonder if you can elaborate on two of them I'll mention. One is the balance of confidence and humility. And I've read it, we've talked, I've seen it, and that is you have to have almost indescribable confidence to do what you have done over and over again. And yet you always, like Maritza Shelley and others, you always are quick to bring other people in, to cite other people. When you're talking about the first ascent, you said, God, they didn't have any of my tools. They didn't have my gear. They didn't have plastic water bottles. They drank water out of old used motor oil cans. So there's this balancing of confidence and humility. And the second thing I'll tee up, and then you can run with it or snuff it out and move something else, is this ability to recognize, and you and I spoke about this offline a few days ago, you accept fear, you respect fear, but fear doesn't lord over you, or however you want to describe it. To me, just even the thought of what you've done terrifies me, but how have you ever, can you speak a little bit, one of the things about times you've reached in for a crevice and a rattlesnake head pops. I mean, have you ever been just seized up with fear?
So, wow, there is a long chain of questions there, and I'm going to answer the last one first. I've seen snakes on crevices, and I do know the gold, black, yellow, everything's mellow, black, yet gold, you're dead. I don't know what the color combination is, a coral snake versus a king snake. And we don't have very many poisonous snakes in Yosemite. We do have the king snakes that aren't poisonous. Of course, we have rattlesnakes, but they are rarely ever up on a cliff where you're climbing. Okay. I've been scared by birds, swallows, coming in and out of cracks, but they just come and fly very close to you. And this is a very trivial answer that's not the big meaning.
No, I love it. I love it. I'm a bird.
I want to key off something you said about humility. I think, is it Cooch? Mike Cooch, is that his name?
Mike Cooch, C-O-O-T-S, Mike Cooch.
You know, like, hey, I'm going to go and do a lifelong passion to preserve sharks, the ones that almost killed me and took my leg away.
Right.
You know, it seems like a weird thing, but I think the humility of like, I fell into this place or whatever, but I also, that's a good word, but appreciation. Like I see people that have lives that are really amazing. And I'm like, how come you're not appreciating how good you have it? You know? And I think people like Coots and others that, you know, the Wonder Woman whose husband had traumatic brain injury from the bomb, she's like, well, this is what I do have. And I'm going to bust butt doing this with what I can control and what I do have. And she appreciated what she had. And she pushed that to the forefront and took care of the things she could control. Now you might think, oh, you know, she's unfortunate, but she had a lot going for her and she appreciated the good things and didn't dwell on the bad things, if you can even call things good and bad. Me and my wife, Lisbeth, have this thing about calling things good or bad, you know. I would say that Mike Coots said it was a good thing he got his leg bit off by a shark after the fact, but bleeding there on the hospital table, you can't think that it's a good thing.
Right, right.
You know, further to the whole thing of like facing fear, my wife, Lisbeth, she has this obsession, if you'll call it that, or persistence to get into cold water. She's doing it now this year, this whole year, once a week in a body of water, a natural body of water. But she'll get into Lake Tahoe when it's really cold in the winter. And she goes, you got to go in and you know how you gasp for breath at first. You got to stay in until you control your breath and you're just breathing normally. I'm like, I'm good. I'll join you for that dunk, but I'm getting out. And when you think like, well, what is in the root sort of human thing about him avoiding this sort of pain, I guess. And, you know, there's this guy Hoff that shows people how they can go bathe in cold water and they can, you know, stay down in there and stay for hours in ice cold water. But I think what more so Lisbeth is doing is your body, if you could separate mind and body, your body tells you, don't do this. Don't go into a tub of cold water or ice water. But you say, no, my brain decides what I do, not me. And you could say, this is facing fear. Like my body fears that it's going to get very cold very quickly. And this isn't good for it, quote unquote. But your mind says, I don't care. I do whatever I want to do. You know, you hear the story. Oh, you're going to get a heart attack if you jump into cold water. How many people do you know? I don't know anyone personally that's ever died from I don't even know anybody secondary that's died from a heart attack going into cold water. So it really, that doesn't make it that's not true, but just
right.
The whole thing is doing something that you fear or that even bodily you can physically get a reaction. You get more of a reaction of fear and scared and danger before you go into the cold water. I know because I've done it a numerous times with Lisbeth. Far more so than the actual act of getting in the cold water and being in it. I think back at some places, like I was climbing the last few days with my partner, Keith, and we were up 500 feet on a cliffside. And I know that I've gone up that route and soloed it without a rope 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And I'm like, huh, thinking back about that, not having a rope and being, you know, 1,000 feet up, that seems today, looking back, that seems kind of dangerous. But then when I did it, I wasn't any more physically gifted. That didn't make any difference. Just I was focused on what I was doing and in very much control of what I was doing and you know, having this sphere or bubble around me that I'm in control of this area and nothing's going to go wrong here. But this is a super common question when I do bankers or salespeople, mainstream audiences, when I give a talk, is that they'll, hey, do you know that guy, Alex Honnold, who free soloed El Cap? Is he crazy? And I'm like, no, he's just very aware of his abilities. And I always point out the parents or grandparents going up on a ladder to put their Christmas lights up. And this is a sad statistic that every year people die putting Christmas lights up.
Right.
And the comfort level you, whoever the listener is, holding a rung on a ladder, your comfort level doing that is the same as myself or Alex holding on to a stack of four quarters glued to the side of a perfectly smooth building. We can stand on those with the same amount of effort and hold on to them as you holding a rung on a ladder. So we wouldn't be scared to go up and put Christmas lights just soloing the side of your building, so to speak.
It's a great, fair point. It's not just putting Christmas lights, it's shoveling snow, right? How many people die of heart attacks? They go out and they shovel snow. But I'd like to come back to your Janet asked a question about, you know, were you this kind of crazy, I don't know, whirling dervish, Dennis the Menace, whatever you want to call it. You know, a guest a couple of times ago, Art Gilbreth, 82nd survivor, 82nd Airborne guy. He was young when he was like, I don't remember, 7 years old, 8 years old. His parents lost track of him, and they looked up on one of these expansion bridge in San Francisco or whatever, right? And he was up there climbing. He was way up there climbing on this cable when he was a little kid. And so it's not surprising to me that Art now today in his 80s is riding souped up Harley Jim's 131 motorcycles screaming across the desert in his 80s, because he said, I always loved and I still love things that give me a rush. Now, when do you recall when you first climbed on that boulder, wherever that is in the slow area? I'm sure I've driven by it. Did you get this like endorphin hit or something? What really said, oh my God, I got to get me some of this.
Well, I should say that I came to climbing from an athlete's point of view. I'd always been an athlete, whether it'd been soccer or tennis or track and field. Right. And in the 80s, there was no competitions in climbing. And so the majority of people in climbing came to it because they had cut off blue jeans and they were going to nature and the wilderness because their parents told them not to, or because whoever was in charge told them not to. You know, the classic Camp 4, you know, group in Yosemite, although their, you know, peak performance time would have been 60s and 70s, it was the drug culture. And I'm here living out of a tent because that's anti-society, you know. And there was a good amount of nature lovers. I'm just exploring nature and vertical terrain in the climbing world when I started. It was prior to climbing gyms. It was prior to climbing competitions. But I still came to it as an athlete. And this is a cool recreation where I have this, I like the term quiver of tools on my back, which might be, you know, protection and carabiners and ropes, where I can now, I'm an all-terrain vehicle. I can go and climb any terrain you put in front of me. And I thought that that was cool. And as far as endorphins, I've known for a long time in my life that a great physical workout, which climbing can certainly provide, is more a healthy high than any drug will ever do. And by healthy, that makes it sound all goody two shoe, but like I've had euphoricness from climbing, you know, 23 hours in a day and just like passing out from exhaustion, or before passing out for exhaustion, you're just like, oh my gosh, you mentally can revisualize what you did that day. Your body is completely spent. Every chemical in your body that was possible to be used from every gland you have has been used, and you're just cooked.
Right.
That's an amazing high. And I think it's very much different than I'm going to jump off a bridge with a bungee cord on and boom, oh my gosh, you know, your heart's almost stopped, right? That's a different type of rush, as your guy on the motorcycle said, perhaps that instantaneous scary thing, jumping out of an airplane or bungee. It's different than the athletic long-term high that you get, a mountaineer might get from, you know, doing a 20-hour up and back summit ascent, or a climber of my type, you know, climbing 5,000 feet in a day in Yosemite or some other place. So I'd say my high is more spread out, I guess, than a, what would be the equivalent? I guess a whipped cream hit, two glasses of wine spread out over 3 hours. I don't know, something like that.
Do you feel that there's an element of serenity that you get from it as distinct from the rush or the high? And I ask that because I love to be out in nature. I could not climb a boulder right now to save my life, but I love to be out in nature and I just feel relaxed. It's so serene. And that's what I get out of it. Is there an element of that in there for you?
Certainly. A lot of people will accuse me of not stopping to smell the roses because I'm Mr. Speed Climber. And I'll say, well, I just like to smell lots of roses. I remember distinctly being up on Mount Slessy in the Northwest Territory. I think it's the southern end of Canada, just above Washington. And me and my good friend were Mark Cruz. We were trying to do 9 classics from this Bible of climbing called the 50 North American Classics. And we're up on this, it's a big mountain. And I'm a t-shirt and shorts climber, by the way. I'm not a mountaineer that goes to Everest or such, but we were on this big mountain and it's very pyramid shape. And the climbing's not fairly, it's not so difficult. It's kind of scrambling almost. And we were on this ledge and there's this beautiful little moss lichen with purple flowers on. It's just like this cutesy little garden nature made on this ledge. And I'm like, I'm going to take a picture of this, Mark, to show that I stop and smell and look at the roses. And he's like, great. He rolls his eyes. But, you know, just this last weekend or last 3 days with Keith, he's like, Hans. I'm like, what? And he goes, would you please look down? And I'm like, what? And he's just like, look at that view. And I'm like, oh yeah, the view, you know? So sometimes it takes somebody with me to like pull my head up from, you know, looking at the climbing and the crack and where's the next piece of protection going to like, look where you're at. Oh, look at that golden sunset on Half Dome over there and profile of the sun coming across El Capitan over there. Like, oh man, this is pretty amazing. And this metal below us, I'm like, okay, yeah. All right. This is good. Sometimes it takes that second person to point it out to me because I'll get into like, we got to get to the back to the car, you know?
Well, I love the fact that you stopped to take a picture of the lichen, because for me, the majestic vista that you see from the top of a trail, the top of a mountain, what have you, that's spectacular. But the little strange bark formation or the little grouping of lichen, to me, that's just as good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the little, if you call them ecosystems that you find in weird places is, yeah, I mean, I've been to, they call it the 8th summit, which is Karstens Pyramid in Papua New Guinea. And we walked 9 days through the jungle to get there. And I mean, one day you're in this just lush, thick, crazy jungle. And the guys are chopping a space out for you for your tent. And like, you're just as far as you can see, which isn't very far, you know, 100 feet into the woods. It's just green, thick vines coming down. And you look down at what you're standing on and you realize you're not standing on the earth. You're standing on roots. Like this lattice of roots, and you poke your hiking pole in and it goes past where you can poke it. And you're like, I'm 4 feet above the ground. I've been walking on roots the last, you know, 200 yards. Like you're raised above the earth on these roots. Like that doesn't happen anywhere I know of in the US. So just these strange, because I get to have climbing take me to cool places, I get to just, wow, look at the wild things there are on just that the earth has created, let alone, you know, different cities that humans have done crazy stuff. But I feel super fortunate that for me, climbing has gotten me to go see crazy cool things like that, you know.
You wrote about how much you liked Jim Collins. I think it's Jim Collins, is Good to Great, the book, yeah. Good to Great, and how that whole, that philosophy, why if you've got something good and you think you can make it, go after great, why I took it from you, you just couldn't even understand why you wouldn't try to go to be great. I mean, are there any other books or philosophers or films that really stick with you that are your favorites? I'm not talking about climbing ones. I'm talking about just general stuff. I mean, did you prefer Petticoat Junction or the Flintstones? Or, I mean, what's your kind of entertainment?
Well, again, now I'm going to end on what you start with. What you ended on is I probably went 20 years without looking at a TV just because I was having too much fun with life. And I've had lots of influences. I mean, I was brought up a Christian. And so I'm not now one, but I think it's just, there's brilliant, brilliant lessons in Proverbs and in the Bible to live by that are perfectly logical, and they work, frankly, to live a good or even purposeful life. As I don't know what good and purposeful, if they're different, but so there's a non-climbing book I'd recommend, the Bible. You know, you don't have to be a Christian to be, or probably just stick to Proverbs would be a good one, because other stuff is tricky in there. Even in Proverbs, it says, do this because God will like you for it. And actually do this because other people around you will like you for it. You know, isn't that enough? Or you might feel integrity towards yourself for doing such a thing. And that's, I think that people, this is what I want to get back to, is people listen to podcasts or programs. I do, hoping that I'll learn something. Now, what does learn mean? Learn to improve myself. Or learn so that I can overcome some problem that I'm having, or maybe a problem I didn't know I had, or a challenge that I have. Problem seems kind of weird, but I'll say that people like Mike Kutz and other people you've interviewed, people that seem like incredible folks or uncommon folks, I think that being open to, if you're a, I don't know, Republican, opening a book about, ways to live good by an excellent Democrat is a great idea. And if you're a Democrat, do the opposite. Look for ways to live great or do some good by a Republican. Because in places where you, it's kind of like getting in cold water. Your body tells you not to do it. And if you're a Democrat, you're not supposed to read anything by a Republican. And the reverse, you find lessons in uncommon places is a great thing to think of. And I don't know, maybe I just came up with that.
Really, that's a wonderful, whether you came up with it or not, that's wonderful. And we don't like to talk politics, but the way you handled it, Solomon. I don't think Solomon was the guy who did the Proverbs, but well done. Very well done. Very diplomatic.
Here's a great example. It's climbing gets me to travel. And I went to France 3 times and I realized shoot, I've never been to the Louvre. All right. The next time I go to France, I'm going to go to Paris. I'm going to go to the Louvre, because you should go to the Louvre. I don't know. You should go to that museum because it's cool. So I did. But what I find is that I'll walk down the street in another country and I'm like, oh, what's that? That's a hardware store. Those are different than hardware stores in the US. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to poke around and look at stuff. And sure enough, I'm in Iceland. I go into a hardware store and there's this weird gizmo that they use to close windows with. It's like nothing I've ever seen in my life before. And I'm pretty handy with hardware stores in the US. And I bought 3 of these clasps that close windows, and I've shown them to so many people I know in handyman construction business here. They're like, I've never seen anything like that. And it's totally functional and totally like this parallel universe of a neat gizmo someone made in Iceland to close windows that we've never seen in the US. Well, what is the lesson there, Hans? I don't know. It's think out of the box. I never go to strip joints. I don't know. It's not, I was brought up a Christian, but I don't go to strip joints because I think I'd blush and I'd be uncomfortable, right? But someone's, well, you should go to one if you've never been to one, and if you're going to be uncomfortable, oh God. my wife, we went to, this is not the same, but we got all dressed up and we went to a speakeasy 20s club thing that they do, this kind of immersion theater, they call it. So you kind of become part of the play and you do this cool thing, as in San Francisco, of course, but they have in lots of cities these speakeasies, immersion plays. And it's nothing I'd ever done before. And I was uncomfortable, but I went and did it. And it was super fun. You get up on stage and you pretend you're there with the act, and people throw you off stage, kind of push you off, and you're like, oh, I got to be, this drunken whatever. Just trying something that you wouldn't normally do. I think there's lots of lessons in it, you know, within reason, that you're not going to get physically harmed from it or mentally harmed, I suppose, too.
I agree with that 100%. And it is in line with something that I learned, believe it or not, as a lawyer. The best advice I got as a lawyer was this. My mentor was helping me learn how to take a deposition. And his advice was, be curious, be open to new facts, and follow up something that your witness says just because you're curious about it. And I think that same thing applies in life. And it's kind of what you were talking about, you know, go into the hardware store because it's interesting, it's cool, it's different. You're curious about it and you're learning something, but that's not the point. The point is that you're having an interesting experience. I think being curious is an excellent lesson for anyone in life, my opinion.
You see these awesome adventure movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark or Sorcerer's Apprentice is one that sticks out in my mind, where you're in a foreign country or you're in New York and you, or whatever, England if you're from the U.S., New York if you're from England, and you go into some pawn shop or some, you know, antique collector's shop and you find the genie vase in the back room. Well, what the heck were you doing there, you know? it's amazing. Something as simple as, hey, I'm a guy, so I used hardware store, but like I'll go into a women's shoe store in Paris. Like I have no business going in there just to see what the heck is in there, because you can see this in a movie. You can see, but like you're there anyway. Why not just walk into this, I don't know, a candle shop or a chandelier shop in Timbuktu, you know, and go to the back and look around like you're looking, and the person asks you a question. You're like, oh, I'm just looking, just like 99% of the other customers. He doesn't know that you're a knucklehead that Hans gave you advice to go into their shop, right? But I have struck up the most incredible conversations with people in the oddest locations. And that's another thing that me and my wife, Lisbeth, try to do. We run this challenge list called Do Hard Things Challenge. And one of the challenges is try to get 2021 new names to you this year. Last year was only 2020. So like, you know, you ask the checkout clerk their name, and it's amazing just asking people's names, how all of a sudden they like look at you and like, oh, you recognize me as a human being. You know, just interacting with people is a great way to learn, I guess, rather than keep your head down, do your checkout, and don't say anything to the person checking you out at the grocery store or the gas station or whatever. Like, that's not being very present to the people around you, I guess.
That's a great point about asking people their name. It just really does center just immediate respect, immediate dignity. And do you have any tips? We're coming around a little bit. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your mom if you want to, but we're coming, and maybe just before that, do you have any, you've mentioned great things, do curious, uncommon, different sources, outside the box. Those are great, great tips for finding ways to find the heat. You know, when you talk about finding the heat, finding your passion, you know, it's not like, I guess, going in with an infrared thing and seeing this blue flame coming out of a wall and go, there's my heat over there. I mean, you've given us some tips for finding it, but did your mother help? Here's a segue, a pivot. Did your mother help you find the heat?
Certainly. I mean, the early days of taking us outdoors, I mean, not just her, but my dad. But, you know, a key thing was when you find out your daughter or son is getting in with that group of people or that particular endeavor, you have a choice as a parent of either covertly or openly trying to dissuade them from doing it, or covertly or out in the open encouraging them to do it, right? I think those are kind of the four choices when you find out your child is doing something, right? And my mom, I could see there was hesitation, yet when I said, hey, I'm going to go for the record on the nose with somebody, she's like, oh, me and dad are going to come camping in Yosemite then that weekend. We'll be there for you. I'm like, whoa, okay. That to me was openly encouraging. And I don't know, I can't go as far as saying as accepting of what I was doing, but she encouraged and supported me in whatever I did, you know. And, you know, to that point, she encouraged me openly, whatever, to go and get a 4-year, 6-year degree in business at college. Very mundane, sort of normal thing from a white Anglo-Saxon person that I was from an upper middle class neighborhood, you know. So she was exceptional mom and encouraging me with whatever road I decided to go down.
Well, great, great tribute to yeah. her. Do you have a charity? Everyone has, we ask everyone, you know, a favorite charity that we can give a shout out.
What's that? Gosh, Don, this is really bad that I can't think of
it. You can spend it later, but if it comes to your...
It's not Deloitte and Touche. What's a competitor to them? Schwab. That's right. I have 2 Schwab accounts for my kids' college funds. DM me. DM me and I'll give you the number, right?
Where is that? Which Proverbs is that? I'm sure that's somewhere in the Proverbs.
About foundations and creating a living legend for yourself or leaving a legacy and all these things. I've heard that from people ever since, you know, before I was a celebrity climber, I guess. And I've not done something, put my name on something, but I have supported for over 2 decades, the Access Fund and the American Alpine Club. And that's just as selfish to me as getting a college fund for my kids, because the Access Fund keeps climbing areas open for all recreational users. And the American Alpine Club does a myriad of work to make climbing accessible to everybody and to me. So those are very, just to me, as selfish as giving you my kid's Schwab account, because it does a great deal for me. Okay. And there you go.
Well, we'll use those. We'll put those in. And just to be fair about your mom and your dad, you did mention your father. I mean, your father was was in the Army. Did you mention you're an Army brat, right?
He was a full bird colonel. He was a veterinarian. Initially, he actually worked on animals for the Army in France and other places. And then I think the Food and Drug Administration hires the Army to do a lot of things. So his last post was inspecting grains going to Russia in the late 70s. So,
wow. Did he ever go climbing with you or anything? A sport? Was he a sportsman like you?
He was very much a sportsman, and he was, a lot of my friends in the early days of climbing noted how he would attend and help out at a lot of the competitions or climbing events, whatever they might be. And he was a good spirit. He was the person that I recognize as when something goes, let's say, wrong or bad or hard, you have 2 choices. You can laugh or cry. And he would always laugh and do it. Yeah.
Oh golly, that's a great way to come near our close. I you can say anything else you want. You can jump in, but I'm gonna pivot. Unless you want to talk about something else, I'm gonna pivot towards the close. You good?
I wanted to know, was it Janet that you grew up in a corn community?
Yes, I grew up in Northern Illinois. There's a lot of corn around there, and in fact, my childhood home abutted an actual cornfield.
So every 2 or 3 years, we would make it back to my grandfather's corn farm in Cherokee, Iowa. And why I'm mentioning that, bringing that back to something meaningful to end on, is that, you know, there's no place flatter than corn country.
Right.
And like, here I am a climber, right? Like,
that's funny.
I talked about getting lessons from uncommon sources, but you just don't, you know, to the listeners out there, you can be a city person and go nature. You can be a nature person and go city. There's 1,000 different, you know, dualities that I could name, from flat cornfield to, you know, the Himalayas. But look for crazy ways that you where you end up, quote unquote, may be very different than what your upbringings are. So be open to it, I guess. And, I want to say is that people ask me what motivates me, because you asked about if Foots and myself and others motivate others. Motivates me is doing what they said couldn't be done.
Well, Wow, that I'm glad you spoke on both of those things, the cornfield, the mountains, and the motivation, what couldn't be done. Okay, Hans, there was a moment when you had a little spill a few years back on the various devices. One's called a nut and one the pitons and all these fancy things. But if I remember, it was a nut and you thought it was secure and you were about 2,100 feet in the air and you stepped on it and you tested it. You thought it was firm and it gave way and you fell backwards. And as you described it in your interview with Outside Magazine, I think it was, there were about seven moments, separate instances that I counted that I would have just been so freakishly, I would have just blacked out, that you were falling, that you realized it was giving away, that all, I mean, tell us a little bit about that incident and whether it was as harrowing or harrowing at all for you as it was just for me reading about it.
So I think this is a good cue to stop the podcast because I don't really want to talk about it.
Okay.
All right. Just kidding. This is a sport that has danger in it. And, you know, danger attracts people to things. And that's part of our society, like Indy 500 or NASCAR racing. People watch because they want to see an accident, you know. Of course, I never wanted to see myself get hurt, but I knew the risks, some of the risks. I guess I knew all the risks climbing. And I try to take precautions to not have these things happen. That was the 109th time I was on that particular place where that nut popped out on me. And I was climbing with an experienced partner who was actually down below a corner and couldn't see me. And he was taking care of cleaning up the last, what we call pitch of climbing. So I was by myself leading up this next pitch. And the technical details were that I had 18 feet of rope of slack from me to the last good piece. And the cliff or the ledge was 15 feet below me. So that math doesn't work. I hit the ledge before the rope caught me. And then I fell three more feet dangling there with the now broken legs. And because I had a helmet on and I didn't really hit my head so much and I was conscious and everything, was able to pull myself on the ledge. And immediately when my foot touched the wall, it was searing pain, a 10 out of 10. I looked down and of course there's a angle turned in my tib fib. I could see like that's not normal. It's broken. And both right and left were broken. And I pushed myself up onto the ledge. I sat and I immediately, without even thinking, just grabbed my phone, dialed 911, and within less than 30 seconds, they had me talking with the rangers that do search and rescue there in Yosemite. And so it was just one of those things where my body and mind just said, well, what do you have to do now? You're in this situation. You just need to now start taking care of it. And this is what my good friend and partner who was with me at the time, Abraham Shreve, he said, Hans just didn't even focus a millisecond on what he couldn't fix or what he, you know, couldn't do. He couldn't fly himself off of there. He couldn't fix his broken leg. But what he could do is call for help and get a rescue started and all this thing. And that's exactly what I did. It's just my natural, I guess, get things fixed sort of thing. Maybe women have a problem, I think, sometimes with men. All they want to do is fix things. Why can't they let them be? But Abraham came around the corner and he looked up and I'm sitting on the ledge talking on the phone, which is very unusual for you to be lead climbing and stop to talk on the phone. That's an understatement. And he's like, hey, I think he said, what the fuck are you doing, Hans? And I'm like, oh, I'm talking to the rangers. I got to get a rescue. It's like, why is that? And I go, I've broken both my legs. And he's just like, head in his hands. He's just like, what? And so I had him lower me down to where he was at. And we kind of strategized with the rangers. And so then we have, you know, we figure some amount of time to wait until the rangers arrive. So he's coiling up ropes and organizing ropes because he's got to lower me down to a safer ledge where they can pick me off. And I can't do anything, which is really frustrating for me. I can't help coil ropes because it's super windy. If I move, then it bangs my leg against the rock and it's so painful I just can't bear it. I'd probably pass out. So I'm just trying to sit still. And I'm like you know, Abe, I can't help you with rope, but there is something I can do. And he's like, what? And I'm like, I can make a social media post. And he's just like, I go, hey, well, how about we do a live video? And he's just like, no, don't do that, Hans. Come on, man. Nobody else would do this. Let's do it. So I proceed to start filming us and like, hey, I'm up here on El Cap, just broke both my legs. I should be down. Sounds like search and rescue is coming to get us. And I, you know, it's one of these things you can laugh, you can cry, or you can just start working on getting the thing fixed. And that's what I did. I laughed and just started working on getting fixed. And, you know, I'd say the effect on other people was, if you just want to measure it with numbers, at that time, I would post videos or pictures on my social media, which Instagram is the one of choice. I would get the very most views I'd ever get is like, I think 3,000 views of a video or something then. Well, I got, I think, very close to six figures. I think I got like 95,000 views.
Wow.
On this video of me just talking, saying, oh, I'm on the side of El Cap and I have, it just, people thought it was, you know, I don't know, James Bond, like doing stitches on his own heart or something.
So. Well, so let me break it down just a moment. So when I'm guessing that's not the first time that a nut gave way or something gave way. And, you know, even after you've tested, but did you know right away that the rope was too short or too short for you or too long? Did I get it backwards? 18 versus 15.
Yeah. At 32 feet per second squared, you know, knowing beforehand and during and after is all the same moment kind of, but when that pop hit, I immediately knew something bad's going to be the result of this. And as soon as I broke both legs as I impacted broke the heel on my right leg and the tip fib on my left. When I hit the ledge, that millisecond, if you'll call it that, there was, you know, shooting 10 out of 10 pain. And then I flipped upside down and slammed against the wall upside down because my rope carried, I had momentum to go over the ledge and just 3 feet below it. And as I rotated upright, it was just like, this is one of those things like, you know, if you've ever been in a car accident, you're just like, please, no. Let me just reverse the last 1 second, you know, of my life. Let me reverse just this 1 second. If I had one genie wish, let me reverse this, you know, but you can't dwell on something you can't fix. So it was immediately turned into, what can I do now? You know,
that last statement, you can't dwell on something that you can't fix. That kind of positive attitude and the idea of moving on and doing what's necessary. I think, Eric, you can tell me if this is true. I think that has been common to every single guest who has talked to us on the Tiger Gene. And I think that's an integral part of the Tiger Gene.
Yeah, successful people do not dwell on the past. Successful people let go of the past quickly.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think we early on someone was talking about how you know the Holocaust survivors are the ones who move on. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that's another part of the genome in there, and that's a great point. I'd like to focus for a couple minutes on the rescue. You mentioned it was really windy up there. And I'd like to just give a shout out to all the rescuers out there, the first responders out there everywhere, including Yosemite flying these helicopters. This takes me back to the Canadian Navy chopper pilots who were flying in gale force winds to rescue these survivors. And I've got to imagine it's very comforting for you, Hans, to know these men and women are up there ready to help you and others who need help to come pluck you off the side, or, you know, it's got to be so many great first responders out there saving people every day. Just deserve a shout out, I think.
Agreed. And, you know, I'm terribly embarrassed that I needed their help for sure. And I just never, this is something, you know, we talked about earlier about the grandeur and the reverence of Yosemite, is that the uniqueness of it is that it's wild, and I got to emphasize that word, it's wild terrain, and it's incredibly, and there's wild terrain in other parts of the world, Kazakhstan, Patagonia, Baffin Island, similar wild terrain, but there is no place on the planet where there's wild terrain like this and amazing accessibility. You park your car a 14-minute walk from the base of a 3,000-foot cliff. Yeah. That is nowhere else on the earth. It's amazing, the accessibility and the amazing wildness combination. And I try my best not to take advantage of the fact that you can call 911 and be rescued in a, you know, in my case, a few hours. Yeah. Appreciate those people to no end.
I'm going to pivot in and just thank our pit loving corn husking Illini, Janet, co-host, and our producer Mia Horvath, who suggested today's amazing guest, and our scrappy, talented editor, Catherine Lane. And last but not least, definitely not least, I'd like to lead a mighty shout out roar by way of salute and thanks to Hans Florin for sharing with us his astonishing story and philosophy and helping us all realize that, believe it or not, we all share the same genetic traits that can help us ascend seemingly insurmountable heights much faster than we could ever imagine. Until next time, I'm Eric Lindner. Pounce on life.